¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, a weekly podcast hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Full of Beans is here to share the unheard voices of those who are living with, supporting, researching, or working in the field of eating disorders. Each conversation aims to bring a different perspective and understanding so that together we can learn, advocate, and connect to realise we are not alone in our struggles and that recovery is possible. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode. And just a gentle reminder that these episodes are not a replacement for therapeutic support. So if you are struggling, please do reach out and know that there will always be someone there to listen. And finally, thank you to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital, for your continued support. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Sarah Woodruff. Sarah's daughter Grace has struggled with ARFID and anxiety and is also autistic. Sarah shares her experience of supporting Grace through lots of school trauma due to her anxiety and how this has led to the development of ARFID. We also talk about the term late onset ARFID and how this can be misinterpreting the age that people can get ARFID, which is something that anybody can struggle with. I really hope you enjoy this episode, and to anybody listening, if you're also supporting a loved one with ARFID, please know that you're not alone. Hello and welcome back to the Full of Beans podcast. Today I am joined by Sarah Woodruff, who we had on the podcast a few weeks ago talking about her experience of ARFID with the other mums from the Three Mums One Mission ARFID. So it's so lovely to have you back, Sarah.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's great to see you.
How are you doing today?
Yeah, good. Just very cold. Glad that January's halfway through.
Yes, I have to say, and I think everyone hates me for this, I'm going to Thailand in a week. So I cannot wait to be warm. It's going to be absolutely amazing.
That's the best time of year to go away, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Oh,
fantastic.
Would you like to introduce yourself for the listeners?
Yeah, sure. I'm Sarah Woodruff, mum to Grace, and I've started a podcast with two other mums, One Mission ARFID, and we sort of started the podcast just because I think all of us felt a bit isolated dealing with ARFID. You can kind of feel like you're the only person in the world going through it with your child. So, yeah, we kind of started it so that everyone can have somewhere to go, that they feel like they're not alone. And our mission really was just if one mum listened to it, it would be, and help them, it would be an amazing thing. So that's really how it's all come about.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. I'm sure that it's helping so many people, because I think, from my experience of being within the community, there's definitely so much more talk about ARFID and people wanting that support, but the awareness sort of outside of the community is still quite limited. So yeah. I can imagine having, you know, the conversations that you guys have as something to listen to being really, really helpful for those people that are like, I just don't know what's going on.
Exactly. And I think because GPs still don't know about it routinely, you can actually feel like you're going a bit mad, like the problem is with you. And I think there is a little bit of that going on where it's like, no, you're just not being strict enough. So I think it's a bit of a sanity thing. It's like a sanity lifeline to say, no, it's okay, you're not making it up, there is something, trust your instincts, you know. And I think that was a big thing for me, because I did genuinely think I was absolutely going mad. So
yeah, absolutely. And did you want to share a bit about what your experience has been?
Yeah, sure. So Grace was a brilliant eater, amazing, like weaned like a dream, which was funny because my son had actually been very, very fussy, and I'd been very stressed when he was small. And the second time around, absolutely fine. The only thing she did have a reflux problem, very early baby. And she did have a cow protein issue, but bless her, she took to soya milk, like, you know, absolutely no problem, didn't really care. And we were very lucky, really. We sort of sailed through. She was a very, she was quite an experimental eater, you know. I mean, I remember giving her, she tried Moroccan at four, you know. She's the kind of child that you were like, wow, okay, I've never had this experience before. Whereas Daniel was still on his sort of very beige food and, you know, occasional sort of pepper, if I could get it in his mouth type thing. She was like, oh, yeah, I'll have a bit of couscous and what. And you were like, wow. So he sort of sailed through to about eight, I'd say, seven or eight. And we noticed over a summer, we noticed that she started to sort of slightly drop food, more quantity. I think it was range as well, but more quantity I think became worrying for me. And I've got old diaries where I've kind of written down going, okay, what's she eating today? Like, and it takes you as a mum, it takes you a bit of time, because you know what it's like, it's busy, they're eating, they seem to be eating, but you suddenly go, oh, she looks a bit like, you know, she's lost some weight. Obviously I didn't routinely weigh her, because you don't necessarily, and I started to get a bit worried. And I think it was a photo I saw. She was a bridesmaid, and she had this lovely little dress on, purple dress on, and I could see like her collarbone like sticking out, and I was like, oh my goodness, like how have I not noticed this? And it was kind of over, it was 3 or 4 months, and it sort of just gradually got a little bit worse. She was sort of restricting to probably 10 to 15 foods, I'd say. Cold, it suddenly, like, she wouldn't eat hot food, and we were like, gosh, what's going on here? She did have problems at that time at school. She started to sort of hit the stage where, you know, a little bit of, you know, falling out with a couple of girls and all that sort of thing, so we kind of put it down to that. Encouraged her to sort of, you know, try and keep going. She was eating, so I think it was at that stage that I kind of went, I think we do need to go to the doctors. Went to the doctors, obviously very dismissive. She, you know, as far as they were concerned, even though she'd lost quite a lot of weight at that point, they were very much, oh, it's fine, you know, just she'll be fine. She's always been slight, I think he said. And I was like, well, she is slight. She's very small, but she's never been like this. And I think it was, I said, I'm not leaving your office until you refer. Because I, at that point, she seemed to be suffering a bit with gastro problems, like a little bit of reflux again. And I thought, well, maybe that's just putting her off the food. And he was a bit like, oh, you know, and very reluctantly, and sort of made me feel like I was being a fussy mum, referred. And we waited for months for this, like, gastro thing. We went through about 2 years on and off of, like, gastro tests and issues, kind of endless tests, including horrifyingly, and I feel a little bit ashamed about this, an endoscopy, because I was so desperate to get to the reason why. You know, I was like, well, no one's told us there's anything else, there must be something, it's something's putting her off her food. And at that point, we kind of had a few years of her being better at eating, then worse again, and going through periods. And it did, to be fair, coincide with whatever was going on at school a little bit. She was amazing in lockdown. You know, she was at home. She, you know, thrived. She looked the healthiest she'd looked for years. And it was really the problems kind of escalated when she went back to school after COVID. And she hated the online. She suddenly started to get loads of sensory issues. She decided she couldn't look at screens, and she literally, I mean, for a child to say, I'm not going to look at a phone, a screen, I mean, she didn't have a phone, she was too young, but she didn't want to look at any of her little handheld like DS type things or anything like that. And we were like, wow, okay. And in some ways we were like, well, great. I mean, a child that doesn't like screens. But in another way, we were like, okay, no, this is problematic, because they obviously had schooling at the time and everything. And so at school, they had to print everything out for her. And this was the first sort of time I started to go, okay, is there something else going on here? She was referred to a neurologist, went through all that, you know, nothing, you know, sort of, I think the only thing they said was she had a slightly inflamed stomach lining. And I was like, okay, you know, and the implication being, well, that's not a big deal, you know, that's, and I suspect that came from when she was very small and she got gastroenteritis quite badly. And obviously that precipitated her being having a CAM protein issue. So I wonder if there was some damage done then. And then basically she went back to school after COVID and went downhill. I mean,
¿quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
She just, over the course of year, end of year 4, year 5, year 6, it sort of just became worse and worse. She was on her own at lunchtimes because she had tummy aches all the time. She was constantly going on about her tummy hurting, but it didn't seem like it was a tummy ache. I couldn't quite make sense of it. She restricted food, not to a dangerous level at that point, more kind of just became much more fussy, started to go off hot food again. We went private in the end. We gave up with the NHS because they just kept cancelling appointments. We ended up paying for a gastroenterologist who, in the end, she'd, you know, done the let's take out dairy, let's take out gluten, let's take out this, let's do that. Nothing seemed to work. She wasn't celiac. So in the end, we ended up saying, right, okay, you know, what is it? And she said, I think it's psychological. And at that point, I was like, okay, so we're all linked to, you know, she said, well, are there problems at school? And I said, well, yes, she's never liked school. Mm-hmm. She's always been really unhappy at school. She feels like she doesn't fit. And I think it was at that point I suddenly went, okay, fine. I think we're in a different space from where we were. We got her a counsellor, and it was the counsellor about 5 or 6 sessions in went, have you ever heard of anything called ARFID? And I was like, no. And she literally gave me the DSM-5 and said, here you go, read that whilst I'm in with her and see what you think. She said, I think this is what it is. And at that point, we were sort of headed into fairly challenging sort of territories because she was down to like 8-10 foods max. It was very restricted, slightly strange food, I'd say, for an ARFID child. It was, you know, not all just beige. Weirdly, she was obsessed with lettuce and things like that, which was very odd, but obviously not it would be great nutritionally, but that was it. I mean, that was the only sort of very much cold food again, very small portions. Kept on saying if she ate too much, she was too full, she was going to be sick. And there was emetophobia started to be a problem. So she was very terrified of being ill. And that's really when we kind of got to a point where we're like, okay, we really are in a sort of serious space here. And she was dropping significant food. And at that time, I think we got referred to step 2, which is like the pre-CAMS bit. It's sort of light touch anxiety type thing. The woman was amazing, to be fair, and said, this is really, really outside my level. You know, this is way more serious than, you know, than really what this service is to deal with, but I'm going to stay with you because I'm really worried and I want to refer you to CAMHS and I know that CAMHS is overwhelmed, etc. So she stayed with us, but she was desperately trying to access CAMHS and it took about 4 months. But in that 4 months, she transitioned to King's Langley School, which was secondary. Just socially, just really struggled, had a horrible time with the other girls, and dropped out within 6 weeks. So at that point, she almost stopped eating. I mean, we were almost at, I can't drink water, I can't eat. And we were backwards and forwards to A&E at that point. So we went about 5 times before finally CAMHS got involved and had to intervene to get her into hospital to go on an NG tube, which, to be fair, saved her life. So horrendous, I mean, horrible experience. And there's a lot of trauma associated with the, you know, that the hospital. I mean, not that, you know, bless them, they did the best they absolutely could. They'd never heard of it. They didn't know what they were treating. But they actually did listen, you know, when I said she needs her own food in here to transition her back to food. I need to bring in food. You need to allow me to do that. And they did, you know, they were really good. And we waited for Great Ormond Street. So she went into a unit at Great Ormond Street for about 3 months, I think it was. And I think this is where her autism kicked in. They sort of said to her, right, these are your objectives. This is what you need to do. And actually, weirdly, that just worked for her because she went, I hate it. I want to be out of here. What do I need to do? I absolutely need to make myself do these things. And she sort of almost just took it on and went, okay, fine, I'm getting myself out. So she's now she's eating. She eats incredibly healthily, I have to say. But really well. I'd say a smaller range of food and fairly specific. A lot of cold food still, not massively keen on hot food, but she will eat with us occasionally. We don't push it. We just say, you know, it's lovely if you can join us a couple of times a week as a family, and we do try and do sort of a Sunday or something. Obsessed with sushi, costs us a fortune. But she has really, you know, I mean, I think there's definitely, you can still see there's definitely sort of allow, you know, we still have to operate as a family who has an orphaned child, and we have to check everything. She has now come off gluten and dairy, so there's the added addition of kind of trying to sort of navigate gluten and dairy at the same time, and I do think that has helped regardless of tests. I think there is an intolerance, so that has helped her, but she has, you know, I'm very proud of her. She's done amazingly. Now it's more still school-based trauma that we're trying to deal with, so we're still navigating the SEN provisions and, you know, trying to find her a space where she feels safe at school, which is still an issue. But yeah, so that's sort of a snapshot of how we got where we got. And obviously there's an awful lot of kids out there that are very young. You know, I think in the press there's been a lot of, you know, there seems to be missing the whole part that this is can be adults, this can be, you know, teenagers and adolescents transitioning to secondary or even year six. It's a massive anxiety making time. Yeah. And I do think there's a big link there. So
yeah, I have so many questions I want to ask you from what you said, but that was something that I really wanted to talk to you about, because I know when we spoke about your experience on the previous podcast, you mentioned late onset, and I actually was kind of like, oh, I wonder how you feel about that term. Because, I mean, I've had people on the podcast that have developed ARFID in their, you know, adult years. I think, as you said, we often hear about it occurring in childhood, but it's something that affects people all across their life. And I don't know, from my perspective, sometimes I think that late onset almost reinforces the stigma that it's just a childhood disease and it's almost abnormal to have it slightly later on. But I didn't know how you felt about that.
Yeah. I mean, they definitely do refer to it as late onset. The very small amount of people that actually know about it professionally do sort of tend to, and very much, I know Gillian Harris links it to a lot to school trauma and anxiety and hormones as well at that time. I think there's all a link to that. It does imply, I mean, I do feel for adults who, you know, who sometimes, you know, they can have a choking incident, they can, something can happen, you know, they even seeing someone else being ill. I mean, that's what started Grace off, seeing someone else being ill kind of just precipitated a whole emetophobia. And that does, it very much comes from the anxiety base. But it also tends to be linked as well, I think, particularly in girls, but also in boys, where they're high masking and there's a later diagnosis of ADHD or autism, because they've masked so well in their childhood. I mean, I didn't see it. I don't think I knew enough about it to see it, but also I just didn't see it. So I think there is a big link there to neurodiversity as well. But yeah, it does imply it's only young kids.
And I think that's a really interesting one, because I remember, gosh, when I first started the podcast, like 6 years ago, I remember one of the first episodes I had was with somebody who was doing their PhD on ARFID, and they were, when I spoke to them, they, you know, the kind of awareness of it was a condition that you struggled with if you were autistic. And I think, you know, more and more we are hearing that, you know, you don't necessarily have to have autism in order to struggle with ARFID. But I do think it's an interesting thing what you were saying, and I was going to ask, because you mentioned that Grace is autistic, in the fact of, it sounds as though sort of, you know, that school trauma and that stress related to being in school, you know, it could there potentially be a link to the gastrointestinal issues that was then, you know, linked to the reason why she struggled with food so much? Because I know for me personally, I've not had ARFID, but the gastrointestinal issues that I have from my own eating disorder, like, it, they're awful to live with, and that's all related to stress. I know when I'm more stressed I get worse issues. But do you think that a lot of that, like, masking autism was then kind of, you know, pushing into struggling with food and things like that?
Yeah, I think we massively underestimate, and I know that this is becoming more of a thing about your cortisol levels in your body and what it does to you and the damage it does, and long-term high levels of stress can really wreak havoc on you. And I think as well, I mean, they're doing lots of work on the vagus nerve and kind of like trying to find ways of sort of balancing people a little bit more, kind of balancing is not the right word, but, you know, find ways of calming the nervous system and having, you know, being able to kind of deal with levels, certain levels of stress. But I think if you're autistic and masking, the sensory stress alongside the exhaustion of having to pretend you're okay and normal, I hate that word, but normal, and to fit in, just takes its toll, you know. And I do think for her, I mean, I think we saw signs of that at 8, you know, and we didn't realise at the time how much she was struggling to kind of get through the school day. And, you know, again, I don't even know if there's links also to sort of peaks in hormones, particularly in girls, I suppose. But I do think it does increase, you know, the gastro. Every time she was stressed, you could see the link. And actually, I look back now and go, how did I not see this? But, you know, you kind of focus on the symptom, which is actually what the NHS does as well. Focus on the symptom, treat the symptom, but don't look at the reason behind whatever's happening, you know. So you never really get to the bottom of the bottom of the problem, sort of thing. So I do massively think that, and anyone, you know, anyone struggling in terms of just I don't know, if you've got you struggle academically, you know, if you just find it, or you've just sensory issues in general, but not autistic, sort of, you know, it's an overwhelming education system, I think.
Absolutely.
And I think it is for pupils and teachers. I don't think it's I think it's both.
So. Yeah, definitely. And I suppose with like the autism in mind, I think something I often struggle to communicate, or kind of I think other people struggle to comprehend, is like where you draw the line between somebody having ARFID and then somebody being autistic and having ARFID, because a lot of the things you kind of mentioned in terms of, you know, sensory issues around food, that could potentially be autism, but it's also linked to ARFID. And I think that, you know, we speak about it with anorexia as well in terms of autism and the link, in that, you know, if I can kind of have a set of foods that I feel comfortable with, is that autistic eating or is that ARFID? Like, do you have any thoughts about where you've kind of, and I guess as well, it's difficult because ultimately the person is the person. So we can give all these labels of autism and ARFID and what have you, but it's the person's experience. But I just wondered if, from your experience, you have any way of kind of describing to people that different.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I people have asked me this, you know, they've kind of said, oh, I don't know whether my child is autistic eating or has ARFID. And I generally say, well, if you go out, say you're somewhere, will they usually manage to find something to eat? Now, the difference is that an ARFID child will happily go without food. As a general rule, they find it stressful eating. So you can see a level of anxiety around the actual eating itself, whereas I don't think you see that, as long as, you know, you've got your foods that you like as an autistic person. But generally speaking, you know, I would say you can usually find something to eat, whereas I think with an ARFID person, they will very much be, there is none of my safe food, I will not eat. It's quite, and they sadly will starve themselves, you know. I know autistic kids who are very prescriptive about what they want to eat, but they will kind of bend a little if they can find something that's quite kind of similar. And I think it's just a difference, you know, will they starve themselves? Will they just go without food for days? If they, you know, if you took them on a holiday and they didn't have their familiar foods around them, would they just stop eating? And an ARFID child would absolutely stop eating. They will just down tools and say, nope, this is too stressful, and, you know, that's it. So I think it's very hard. It is very hard to tell. I mean, because we were dealing with very, very fussy eating with Daniel. You know, for us, I think that's why it took us so long to notice as well, because we were like, oh, well, you know, he's fussy, so maybe she's just become fussy type, you know. There is you can generally tell if a child will literally starve, and if they're very, very militant about the food, and if there's other things around it, like they won't sit with you and eat, they won't, they have problems with smells, they have, if there's an awful lot of other things going on as well. Now, some of that can be autism as well, but with ARFID, it tends to be, you can get quite obsessive compulsive behaviors around it. So, you know, it has to be a certain knife and a certain fork or a certain plate, or this, the whole thing around it becomes quite prescriptive. You know, I had, when she was very ill, I had to walk with her, so after she would eat, and then I'd have to walk, which was counterproductive because she wasn't supposed to be exercising at all. And it, you know, it, at one point I was like, oh gosh, is this anorexia? But for her, she had a link between, my tummy's too full, and that's quite a natural thing. My tummy's too full. Actually, what do? When we have a big meal, we might go for a bit of a walk to walk it off, we say. And so I think it was like that. But obviously for me, I was then looking out, oh God, is this anorexic behaviour, or is this, you know, because the link between the two as well is quite pronounced, particularly teens and later. There was no body image, you know, nothing. I mean, she literally hated her body when it was very thin. She would look at it and go, I hate this, I just want to look normal. very different, wanted to put on weight, you know, was really pleased, you know, totally the opposite, you know, she put on a kilo, she was like, you know, it made her day type thing. So yeah.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's so tricky with all of this to know, is this the right thing to be doing? Is this the wrong thing to be doing? Like, how do I approach this? And I think, you know, having that compassion for yourself and for the individual struggling as well, to kind of, no one's given a guidebook on these things, unfortunately. Yeah. And I think that's part of, you know, what makes it so difficult in navigating it. It's kind of really individual as well. So there's not really a right or wrong answer.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And every single ARFID child you speak to, or adult, they it's very different for them, and it's very personal. I think it's quite broad as well. There seems to be a very anxiety driven, it's all got anxiety underneath it all, obviously. But there seems to be like a very anxiety driven one, and ones that are very much more sensory. And then, you know, some that are just totally disinterested in food. Like, just almost like, oh, I have to eat. I hate this. I have to eat. You know, it's that I've just got to do it. And total lack of interest, or, you know, in food. And you always wonder if there's something more behind that, you know, whether there's a taste sensation thing or, you know. So I think it's just so much more research that needs to be done.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that with all eating disorders, but particularly with ARFID, the diversity, as you say, just needs so much more research. And I'm just wondering, because you've mentioned that, you know, Grace is in a place now where she'll come and sit with you, but you've kind of got into a place of, I guess, coming to terms with what is quote unquote her normal, and that being okay. I just wondered if there were any particular things that you found through the process of her recovery that were key things that helped her to get to where she is now.
Yeah. I mean, for her, so, I mean, I think when she was very ill, it was literally just all food is good food. I mean, we always say this, all food is good. It doesn't matter what you eat. If you want to eat a chocolate bar every day, if you want to eat, initially I was always stressed about, oh god, she's not getting any fruit, she's not getting any vegetables. Like, when she was eight, I was like, oh no, you know. And over time, I think I just got to a point where I was like, I just need to get some food in her. And it's so lowering the expectations, so that then took the pressure off her and allowed her to say, okay, well, it's just good that I'm eating something. That was a big thing. I think there were various techniques. We did try various techniques, some of which worked, some didn't. There were things like testing plates. So we would get her to red, amber, green lists. You know, red was the absolute can't go anywhere near that food. Amber was, well, I don't know, I might consider it. And green was anything she was already eating. So that was a safe food. And we kind of then put it all, she wrote it, she was in charge, she, you know, we drew pictures and whatever, and she would then choose, well, what one do I want to try from the amber, and when, you know, that the thing is with ARFID, I think it's about giving complete control and relinquishing the control yourself. I think that was the big thing for me. And that's hard. As a parent, that's very hard, because you're told constantly by health visitors and whatever at a very young age, oh, they need to be having this, they need to be having their fire fruit and veg, they need to be having, don't give them too many smoothies, you know, it's not good for the, you know, it's constant sort of barrage of advice for parents. And I think if you can get to a space as an ARFID parent to go, right, the rules are out now, the rules, just throw them away, you almost like need to write them down and throw them away yourself, or burn them or whatever, and say, let's start again, let's just start again. And it was about her taking control, what would she would eat, and, you know, trying to sort of explain. So a lot of it with her was interception issues, so identifying the difference between anxiety and the funny feeling in your tummy being an anxiety related thing versus full, because she still struggles with full now. So she still, she will always say to me, I'm not hungry. And I constantly carry around food. And I had wondered why I was still doing that when all my parent, you know, mum friends were like, why do you carry around food still? And actually, I hadn't noticed over the years, I'd noticed that she gets hungry. And and there's a small window. She goes from okay to not okay within about 5 minutes. And I was like, gosh, I don't know why I'm doing this, you know. And now I realise, actually, she just doesn't seem to have that internal trigger that says you're getting hungry. So there's no getting, there's not hungry to hungry, and no, nothing in between. So I think, you know, I think things that worked, yeah, the red, amber, green seemed to, that I think that worked for her brain. It was like, okay, that's my challenge and I need to take that on. We had little testing plates with, so she said at one point she wanted to try a different type of chocolate. So like food chaining. So if, I don't know if she was eating, dairy milk chocolate, that was in. So then, you know, introducing a slightly different chocolate. Do you want dairy milk with something in it? Do you want Galaxy? Do you want, you know, and trying to only change one sensory aspect at a time, which is quite hard actually. Like it's almost like, oh my goodness, where do you go from here, you know. She was eating a sausage roll, introduce a different sausage roll, would she then eat something else in a pastry, like that sort of navigating that. So I know some people have very successfully done it, but it's painstaking and it takes forever, but they can get there. I think another thing that does sometimes work is just growing up and peer pressure. Like my son's got less fussy as he's got older because he's realised he wants to fit in with his friends, and you know, they're going to go for a curry, he wants to go for a curry, you know, that sort of, that kind of like, oh, boys eat curry, hot curry, you know, that kind of thing, trying to fit in. And obviously for him he's not Arthur, but
yeah, I was going to say, I wonder if that's, you know, what you were saying about how, like, determining the difference between somebody that's a fussy eater and Arthur. I wonder if that is maybe an example there, because,
yeah,
I don't know, I may just make an assumption, but I feel like the person with Arthur may then unfortunately become quite isolated and not go out with friends because they can't engage in those situations, where somebody that's a fussy eater will think, oh, well, I want to go hang out with my mates. I best just, like, you know, I'll have a chicken korma or something that's, you know, not as spicy as what everybody else is having. I can imagine that as people are then getting older could present as a challenge in terms of that isolation of not being able to engage in those activities.
Yeah. I mean, it can go one way or the other, I think, you know, very much so. And actually, that's one of the aspects of Arthur is when it becomes socially isolating. I mean, the first thing that started to happen to Grace was she couldn't go on school trips that were overnight, you know, because it was too complicated. And she was too anxious. She couldn't go to parties because she got stressed about food there. And, you know, and going around to someone's for a play date meant that she could only go for a short time because I'd have to pick her up before dinner. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, some mums were brilliant. They just said, look, what will she eat? What's she comfortable with? And they're just getting whatever food. But some people, unfortunately, are a little bit more, oh, for goodness sake, you know, I'm sure she can eat whatever. And you were like, no, not really. Like, and it very much made you feel like, oh God, I'm obviously not strict enough. I'm not this. And you know, as a mum, you start beating yourself up. Oh God, I've done that wrong. I've not weaned properly. What did I do? You know, looking back and saying, oh no, where did I go wrong? You know. So for us, I suppose, with the Arthur diagnosis she got finally through the Maudsley, while she was in sort of hospital, was a relief a little bit, because I was like, okay, so maybe it's nothing I did. Maybe we were always destined to go on this path and we just need to learn to manage it. So, yeah.
And I suppose if there's parents listening thinking, gosh, I resonate with everything that you're saying, but obviously it's my fault, it's obviously something I've done, what would you say to them?
I'd say try and read around it, because it does make you feel better. Like, or, you know, I think the relief I found when I read Rachel Brian Wall's book about Arthur, and there was like, you know, was like, oh, thank goodness, okay, so this validates because they describe, you know, all these things and you think, oh, okay, you know, and it's really like there really is nothing that you've done, you know, nothing that you've done. I mean, you know, you may have been dealing with this from weaning and, you know, there is nothing really at that point you do. Like everyone does the usual things. And it's sort of a little bit out of your control. I think it's learning to not beat yourself up, try not to take the stress on. And it's just so much easier sitting here saying that than doing it, because as a mum, seeing your child struggling like that, and also because medically it can become so serious with, you know, I don't know, underweight, overweight, and the sort of malnutrition side of it, I think it's just that stress, you know, that stress of, I should have done something better, I should have, and actually there's nothing you can do. If your child is ARFID, there is literally, all you can do is just take the pressure off both yourself and the child. Try very hard to get rid of the, we have to sit at a table, we have to eat together, he or she has to eat fruit, veg, whatever, you know, just, if it's sausage rolls all day, it's sausage rolls all day. If it's McDonald's chicken nuggets and chips, it's, you know, it, whatever works. It, unfortunately, poor mums end up driving the country looking for, you know, various sort of foods that have kind of gone out of stock places and things like that, which is horrendous, especially branded, you know, where they become fixated on a brand or a packet that looks a certain way. I mean, fortunately, Grace was a bit like that at the worst days, but fortunately we didn't have too much of a problem with that. But I do really feel for these people. They're just, you know, you see them setting off for 2-hour drives to an Aldi because Aldi's got something here, not got it there. So, yeah. I mean,
and it's
horrendous.
Out of control, isn't it? When, you know, the branding changes. Like, I mean, you know, just from a very broad level perspective, but when Pepsi Max changed their logo and I was like, what the hell is that? That's not Pepsi Max. And you can taste like a slight change in the drink, and obviously for me that's, you know, it's like, oh, why have they done that? But it's not something that I'm reliant on. But if you've got so few safe foods and then a change like that happens, I can imagine as a parent, or, you know, the person struggling, it's like, what the hell have you done that? Because that was my that was the thing that I was safe with.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you understand why they change branding and whatnot, but I mean, for someone that's reliant, I mean, I do my heart really goes out to the parents that have to sort of search the country for various specific things. And really, you know, I, even at our low moments, you know, really horrendous, I was always slightly, I mean, I did get very obsessive about sausage rolls. I do have a bit of a PTSD sausage roll thing going on because it, like, when I see them now, I'm like, oh, they bring back bad memories. And, you know, because there was a specific brand, and I do remember us driving around one night kind of having to try and get hold of them because we'd run out. And I was like, oh, God. And also them, you know, then going out a date quickly and stuff and throwing food away. And, you know, I'll never quite look at a sausage roll the same way, I have to say.
I think my mum has the same thing about Subway, as that was one of my safe foods. And now I never walk past Subway, she's like, we're not going there for lunch. Nope, not at all. I'm like, okay, that's okay. You have your reasons, don't you worry at all. But yeah, thank you so much, Sarah. It's been lovely to chat to you. And I'm sure, you know, this will be so helpful for people that are navigating a similar experience. So I will put all the notes to the podcast that you guys do in the show notes. But yeah, thank you so much. It's been lovely.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode on the Full of Beans podcast. I really hope you did enjoy it. As a little reminder, this is not a replacement for therapeutic advice, so please do seek support if you are struggling, and know that there will always be somebody there to listen. Many thanks once again to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital. Have a lovely week, and I will see you next week for another episode of the Full of Beans podcast.